Such a time, lament for not, do not. You're young, all of you. Haram, another. Cha, and Atmanam, yourself. Eva, certainly. Va, or Ka, who. Atma, self. Ka, who. Para, other. Va, or. Atra, in this material world. Siya, one's own. Parakya, for others. Eva, indeed. Va, or. Sapara avineshena, consisting of absorption in the bodily concept of oneself and others. Vena, besides. Agyanena, the lack of knowledge. Dehina, of all the embodied living entities. Translation. Therefore, none of you should be aggrieved for the loss of the body, whether your own or those of others. Only in ignorance does one make bodily distinctions, thinking, who am I? Who are the others? What is mine? What is for others? Purport by His Divine Grace, Sri Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. In this material world, the conception of self-preservation is the first law of nature. According to this conception, one should be interested in his personal safety and should then consider society, friendship, love, nationality, community, and so on, which have all developed because of the bodily conception of life and a lack of knowledge of the spirit soul. This is called ajnana. As long as human society is in darkness and ignorance, men will continue to make huge arrangements in the bodily conception of life. This is described by Prahlad Maharaj as Balaram. In the materialistic conception, modern civilization makes enormous arrangements for huge roads, houses, mills, and factories. And this is man's conception of the advancement of civilization. People do not know, however, that at any time they themselves may be kicked out of the scene and forced to accept bodies that have nothing to do with these enormous houses, palaces, roads, and automobiles. Therefore, when Arjuna was thinking in terms of his bodily relationships with his kinsmen, Krishna immediately chastised him, saying, Kutastva kasmalam idam vishame samupasthitam anayandristam. This bodily conception of life is befitting the anaryas, the non-Aryans, who are not advanced in knowledge. An Aryan civilization is advanced in spiritual knowledge, not merely by standing oneself an Aryan does one become an Aryan. To keep oneself in the deepest darkness concerning spiritual knowledge and at the same time claim to be an Aryan is not Aryan position. In this connection, Srila Madhvacharya quotes as follows from the Brahmavivarta Purana. It's a long quote, but the purport is that as long as we are in this human form of body, our duty is to understand the soul within the body. The body is not the self. We are different from the body, and therefore there is no question of friends, enemies, or responsibilities in terms of the bodily conception of life. One should not be very anxious about the bodies changing from childhood to boyhood, boyhood to old age, and then to apparent annihilation. Rather, one should be very seriously concerned about the soul within the body and how to release the soul from the material clutches. The living entity within the body is never annihilated. Therefore, one should surely know that whether one has many friends or many enemies, his friends cannot help him, and his enemies cannot do him any harm. One should know that he is a spirit soul, aham brahmasmi, and that the constitutional position of the soul is unaffected by the changes of the body. In all circumstances, everyone, as a spirit soul, must be a devotee of Lord Vishnu and should not be concerned with bodily relationships, whether with friends or with enemies. One should know that neither we ourselves nor our enemies in the bodily conception of life are ever killed. Translation again, please repeat. Therefore, none of you should be aggrieved for the loss of the body, whether your own or those of others. Only in ignorance does one make bodily distinctions, thinking, who am I? Who are the others? What is mine? What is for others? Om Ganatara Mandisya Ginatinasya Lapa Chakshuram Vitam Hina Tasmai Shri Burubhina Shri Shaitan Yamanavastam Stavitam Hina Bhutare Swayam Rupa Gadamaya Dadati Svapadantikam He Krishna Karma Sundar Dinabandir Dikarpate Gopesha Gopika Kanta Radha Kanta Namastate Tata Kamsana Gorange Rahe Vrindavanishwade Vishavanasati Devi Pranamami Hadipri Jaya Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Arvaita Garadhaya Shri Vasari Gora Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hiranyakashipu is now concluding his instructions to Diti, his mother, as well as the mother of Hiranyaksha, who had just recently been killed, or rather liberated, at the hands of Lord Varaha, and her daughter-in-law, Vrishabhanu, Hiranyaksha's wife. The wife and mother of Hiranyaksha were so deeply immersed in lamentation over his glorious death at the hands of the Lord that Hiranyakashipu, to console his family members, recited a story from ancient times of the queens of Suyogya, the great hero who died on the battlefield, showing his heroic might. And at his fall, his queens were so desperately clutching and holding on to the body of their deceased husband that they actually impeded his spiritual progress, because they would not let go of the body to be cremated at the appropriate time, and therefore the soul of their husband was hovering as a ghost, neither able to return to the body to which he was so attached, or to become freed from that attachment by the purificatory rite of cremation, which would assist him in receiving his next body. So Yamaraj told this story to the aggrieved queens. Hiranyakashipu repeated it to his mother and the wife of his brother. And through the instructions of Yamaraj, as repeated by Hiranyakashipu, the aggrieved relatives of Hiranyaksha were freed of their lamentation, and they overcame their grief and engaged their minds in understanding the real purpose of life, whereas Hiranyakashipu, who had given those instructions, went off to perform austerities to fulfill his cherished vain ambition of becoming immortal. So we see how the distress caused by material attachment to that which is impermanent, to that which is unreal, according to the standard of reality given by Sri Krishna to Arjuna, that of the real there is no cessation, whereas the unreal has no duration. So conditioned souls subject themselves, because of their own attachment, to so much anxiety, stress, frustration, and misery simply because of misidentification of the self with the body, which is just the outward coverings of the soul, awarded because of her own karma, her own egoistic desire to enjoy separately from the Lord outside the kingdom of God. And therefore the Lord has rewarded our awarded the living entity as an opportunity to try to enjoy separate from Him. Here's your opportunity. An illusory world where the Lord is not visible, and you can try any way you want to become a separate enjoyer. But what is the result? It is utter frustration, anxiety, and misery. Because the spirit soul, which is eternal by nature, whose constitutional position in nature is Satchitananda, eternal, full of knowledge and bliss, comes to identify with that which is temporary, full of misery and suffering. And all our cherished ambitions for life, we know, are going to be finished at death. Everyone is thinking he's the exception. You know, we technologically acknowledge that, yes, I will die, but we don't really believe it deep down inside. Otherwise, we would not be pursuing that which is temporary and which is destined and doomed to annihilation. And with it comes all the frustration and all the misery of having our illusion dispelled before our eyes. Now, you can say that devotees also suffer in this world. Even enlightened souls suffer in this world, and that's true. And it's important to understand that there are two varieties of happiness and distress, which superficially may appear to be identical, or at least very similar. But at their root are as distinct as the spiritual and material worlds. There's basically two types of suffering. There's that born of our karma, which originates with the seed of wanting to enjoy, but produces the inevitable fruit of suffering. And then there's another kind of suffering called Bhagavad Dukkha. And that is the suffering which is very mercifully ordained and orchestrated by the Lord to free us from the root cause of all our bondage and suffering, the bodily conception of life. So the seed of karma is the consequence of one's own activities. And that seed of karma remains even after the suffering which it creates. The seed of enjoyment produces misery as a result, because the enjoyment is not real, it's illusory, and it's temporary. And therefore, our desires to enjoy meet with other frustration and misery, because the desired enjoyment does not last. First of all, it's illusory by nature, it's not substantial, it can't satisfy the heart. It may give some temporary distraction to the mind and senses from the extreme miseries of material life, but that's not enjoyment. It's just a distraction. So it's not for material enjoyment is not satisfying to begin with, and by nature it cannot last, and therefore it is the root of all suffering. But unless and until the root, meaning the desire to exploit, the desire to enjoy, the desire to control separately from Krishna, or in other words, false ego, unless that root is uprooted from the heart, then it will simply create more and more misery, even after suffering the consequences of one's own karma. The seed remains in the heart to sprout in the form of new sinful desires and indulgences and their consequent reactions. Whereas conversely, the root cause of suffering ordained by the will of the Lord is that it lasts only as long as the Lord sees fit and is beneficial to his parts and parcels, the jiva souls, who are like his children. And that suffering, which is personally ordained by the Lord for the welfare of his children, does not perpetuate the cycle of suffering, the cycle of samsara, but blossoms into realization that our only shelter is Krishna. And what do we mean by shelter in Krishna? Shelter at the lotus feet of Krishna. Faith, sharanagati, faith in the surrender and the conviction that the Lord will definitely, surely protect his servant. It doesn't mean he will protect the material body, which is destined to suffering and death. It means he will protect our faith, which is our real connection with him. This distinction between material miseries born of our own karma and those ordained by the sweet will of the Lord, is the contrast is made very distinctly in Yamaraja's instructions in different places. His instructions to the Yamadutas when they were frustrated in taking away Ajaneya to hell, when he was delivered by the Vishnu Dutas. And Yamaraj told in his long and edifying series of instructions to the Yamadutas, don't go near the devotees of the Lord who have taken shelter of the holy name. Why? Because there's no need, there's no reason to punish them. There's no purpose in their suffering, because they're directly under the loving protection of the Lord. If he sees it fit to place them in suffering, that is his will. That is perfect for them, and therefore do not impede his will by trying to punish them who have taken shelter of the Lord as their guru. There is superficial similarity, but as much difference as that between the torture inflicted by an enemy and the chastisement of a very loving and affectionate mother. As much difference as that between poison, meaning karma, selfish interest, separate interest, and nectar, meaning the purifying arrangements that the Lord creates in our lives to help us in the fulfillment of our deepest aspirations in attaining his loving shelter and love and loving, reviving our lost and dormant loving relationship with him. So it is for the reasons of preserving the intimacy of loving faith and enhancing the longing, the ardent longings in the hearts of his devotees, that the Lord allows his own intimate loving servitors to suffer. But the purpose is for their everlasting joy and the fulfillment of their deepest heartfelt aspirations. And in addition, we appreciate things when seen in contrast. You appreciate the sunrise because of the darkness of night. You appreciate cold water in the heat of the summer. And you appreciate a meal when you're hungry. And therefore the Lord places his devotees into different kinds of sufferings so that they can appreciate more his rescuing them, his merciful arrangements to rescue them from this material world. And therefore, through the Srimad Bhagavatam, we're advised to seek the exclusive shelter of Krishna and not to worship demigods as independent or separate from Krishna. We revere the demigods and respect them as servants of Krishna. But those who worship the demigods as separate from Krishna, as Hiranyakashipu is about to do here, are not understanding the nature of Krishna. Some people are prone or inclined to worship Lord Shiva because he is easily pleased. But he's also easily displeased, as is Lord Brahma. And as much as Lord Shiva may be pleased by the worship of his devotees, he easily curses them when he's displeased. Whereas Krishna sees only the good in everyone. And his mercy is that he takes away whatever impedes our own best interest, which is in taking shelter of him. So Krishna sends into our lives whatever will help us surrender. And usually, that is in the form of distress. Queen Kunti elucidates this point so beautifully when Krishna was just leaving Hastinapur, and she was frantic. She said, "My Lord, you've rescued us from so many dangers in the past, in all the calamities, and there were so many for the Pandavas. You were always there. But now that you're leaving, and Maharaj Yudhisthira has been coronated as the emperor, and Krishna, it's wonderful, Krishna was like a subordinate king in Dwarka, whereas Maharaj Yudhisthira was the emperor of the world. So Krishna had compensated for all the injustices which befell the Pandavas due to the evil, egotistic ambitions of Duryodhana and Dhritarashtra. Krishna had corrected everything, rescued the Pandavas, and established them in sovereignty. And then Queen Kunti was frantic. She said, "My Lord, let those calamities come again and again and again, because then we see your loving hand and mercy and protection again and again and again. And that means having no longer to see that horrible face of repeated birth and death." So Krishna takes personal loving care of his devotees. When we surrender to Krishna, he takes personal charge of the actions and reactions which come into our lives. Of course, the response is still within the realm of our own free will. We have to understand that we have the stockpile of karmic reactions, and each reaction is prone to instigate another action and consequent reaction. And thus we're helplessly trapped in the cycle of samsara because of our own misuse of God-given free will. And that stockpile of unmanifest karma called aparabdha begins to manifest in a subtle form as kuta, the desire to again enjoy, exploit, and control, which materializes in the form of bija, the seed, and that manifests as a predisposition and desire which blossoms in parabdha, and the manifest stage of our karma which must bear fruit and play itself out. And therefore we see there is happiness and distress even in the lives of self-realized souls. But they're not overwhelmed by the delusions of sorrow and delight, as the unenlightened souls are, indulging in hankering and lamentation, which just perpetuates their karma. So the enlightened soul merely witnesses the passing of his parabdha karma. He doesn't indulge in it. He doesn't further implicate himself by, and it's not a mere mental adjustment. It is the result of realized knowledge regarding the nature of the self. So, actually bhakti, you know, jnana can give us some understanding of the proper course of action. And jnana can even award liberation. But it cannot actually uproot the seed of ignorance that feeds our karma. Bhakti alone places us under the care of the loving hand of the Lord. And when Krishna calls his lost servants home, being unable to bear their separation, according to Baladeva Vidyabhushana, Krishna at that time distributes the pious karma of his lost servant to those who assisted him. And Krishna bestows that impious karma upon those who have opposed him. Baladeva Vidyabhushana thus speaks of the contrasting effects of knowledge born of bhakti over the power of bhakti, which is free of karma and jnana. So Hiranyakashipu, after imparting his good instructions, citing the authority on the matter, Yamaraj, who's Dharmaraj, then goes off to resume his cherished aspiration of becoming immortal. It is the nature of illusion that we think that we are going to succeed where everyone else has failed. We see this in Krishna's Leela when Trinavarta, after seeing that Putana was killed, Shakatashura was killed, was thinking that he would be the one who succeeds in killing Krishna. And this teaches us something about the infatuating nature of pride, that one loses his discretion, his intelligence, when he becomes infatuated with greed for power. And Krishna cannot tolerate that kind of ego in the hearts of his devotee, and he always brings it down. So, Trinavarta, who represents disloyal controversy, but also who personifies the nature of the mind, which has a tendency to be like a whirlwind, is a cycle, and is impossible for the living entity himself to control. He came to Vrindavan to kill Krishna. And Srila Prabhupada explains that when Trinavarta was coming, Krishna knew it, so he became very heavy in the lap of Mother Yashoda, so heavy that she had to place him down. And then when she placed him down, Trinavarta came and picked him up and raised him high into the sky. And as Trinavarta was raising Krishna higher and higher into the sky, Krishna, who had just been heavier than a planet in the lap of Mother Yashoda, became light like a piece of straw. And Trinavarta was thinking that I am, by my own power, raising him higher and higher so that I can kill and destroy this Krishna. This was a competition in mystic powers. Trinavarta was a powerful mystic who thought that by his own powers he could kill Krishna. And therefore he was competing with Krishna. It was a competition of mystic powers as they rose in the sky. And this tells us something about the nature of our own minds. That the mind, the uncontrolled mind, is competing with Krishna. To whatever extent we want to enjoy, control, exploit material nature, to whatever extent we want to be recognized or praised or adored by others, we're trying to usurp position of Krishna, which means we're trying to kill Krishna. To whatever extent we try to enjoy subtle or gross sense pleasures, we are competing with Krishna. And that perpetuates our eternal struggle with Krishna. The truth is, that one who understands that Krishna is the proprietor of all planets and demigods thereon, the proper enjoyer of all sacrifices and austerities, and the best well-wishing friend of every living entity, he attains peace from the pangs of material nature because he ceases his eternal struggle of competition with Krishna. And from that peace of surrender to Krishna, the joy of the soul naturally blossoms in the heart. To whatever extent we expect or desire name, fame, glory, which is really meant for Krishna alone, we are competing with Krishna. And this is the root cause of all our suffering and bondage. To be an enjoyer, to be a god, to be independent of Krishna. And when others recognize our abilities, or praise our knowledge or strength, or ability or austerity, whenever we excel in any way, the tendency of the mind is to become more and more proud. This is the greatest danger, this is the greatest. As Prahlad Maharaj told Hiranyakashipu, other than the uncontrolled mind, there really are no enemies. Whatever enemies appear in the outer world are simply manifestations of what's in our own heart. So, this pride is the root of all anarthas, all undesirable, unwanted things in our lives. And the problem is, in devotional service, and when we take the process of sadhana and nurture, water the seed of devotional service within the heart by shravanam, kirtanam, vishnu, smaranam, padasevanam, the holy name which nurtures the bhakti lata bija, the seed of devotion within the heart, also nurtures the weed, the seeds of the weeds, beginning with that of false pride. And this may seem very unusual, that the sound of the holy name, which nurtures the seed of devotion, also causes the fructification of that weed of pride, false pride. And the reason is that because the living entity has such a tendency to be proud in his material existence, when he takes to the path of devotional service, people naturally respect devotees. So the problem, the pitfall may be that we cherish this desire that now when I take to the path of devotional service, people will respect me. They'll adore me more than even before. Before I was respected as just an ordinary whatever, but now people will be respecting me even more. This is a weed. This is the root of all other, the root cause of all other weeds. And therefore, surrender to Krishna means we turn our lives over to His loving discretion. We follow His instructions by approaching a bona fide spiritual master, inquiring submissively and rendering service and surrendering to His will. Now, people in this world, they're not inclined to surrender to a spiritual master because He's not going to endorse their egotistic ambitions to enjoy and exploit and be respected and adored. But He will uproot that seed of pride from within the heart by His words and actions and instructions. And that's painful to the conditioned soul. That seed of pride has such deep, all-pervading roots in the soil of our hearts that when it's uprooted, it hurts. And sometimes we feel that our hearts are just going to be ripped apart. But we have to know that that suffering is the means of our deliverance and freedom from the perpetuation of that cycle of karma and samsara, which just perpetuates our suffering and misery in this world. So, a gardener, Mahaprabhu said, has to be very vigilant that whenever these seeds arise, we have to uproot them, lest they compete with the bhakti lata bija for supremacy in our lives. The problem is we're so attached. And therefore we have to transfer that attachment to Krishna. So, Krishna encouraging Trinavarta to raise him higher and higher into the sky demonstrates to us the nature of our own minds, which can be just like a whirlwind. And then when we see that Krishna is competing with our separate interests, the nature of the mind is to try to throw him far away, to cast him aside. So what happened? When Trinavarta felt Krishna to become very heavy, to become a burden, and he tried to cast him aside, little Krishna just embraced Trinavarta, clutching to his neck. And Trinavarta, this great, powerful, mystic Asura, was trying with all his might to throw little, practically baby Krishna, to throw him down. But Krishna clung very tightly because he was thinking, he is approaching me. cannot let him go. So then, the competition for mystic supremacy shifted, and Krishna became heavier than the universe, and brought Trinivarta down, which demonstrates what happens in everyone's life. We may pursue our cherished aspirations of being separate enjoyers and controllers from Krishna, but at the end, Krishna brings us down to lie prostrate on the ground. We have the choice to prostrate ourselves before Krishna in loving obeisance to his sweet will and redemptive mercy. And that surrender is very sweet because it's love. And surrender is actually a very crude word. English is a very crude language because surrender to Krishna is not impelled by force. Actually it is. Because the greatest force in all creation is that of love. So loving and surrender to Krishna is very sweet and liberating. And it frees us from the cycle of samsara and perpetuating karma. And it takes us back home, back to Godhead. But if we do not surrender to Krishna lovingly, in grateful obeisance to his mercy and kindness, then inevitably we will meet Krishna. Srila Prabhupada gave the analogy that you may have an apartment which you think is yours and where you can live happily ever after, but then death comes and takes it all away. And one devotee in the assembly said, that's when you meet the landlord. Srila Prabhupada said, well, yes, in most cases it is. So Trinivarta demonstrates our own struggle of competing with the Lord. And any time, this can be very subtle, any time we enjoy the praise of others, the compliments, or even expect such things, that's the Trinivarta, that's the nature of the mind. We're just trying to compete with Krishna. So how to subdue our own worst enemy in the form of the uncontrolled, unbridled mind? Keep Krishna in your mind. When Krishna is imparting the most confidential instructions to Arjuna, manmana bhava ma bhakto madhyatam namaskriya mama vaishasi santam te pratitane priyosi, always think of me. He means that whatever you do, keep Krishna in your mind. You can go through your sadhana and your mind be someplace else trying to enjoy or exploit or seeking praise or adoration or compliments. And that's contradictory. And Krishna says the same thing in the ninth chapter of Bhagavad Gita, almost verbatim. Always think of me. Keep Krishna always in your mind. And then that whirlwind mind can become subdued by the superior power of Krishna, which is loving and merciful and meant to free us from all our sufferings once and for all and to return us to our home where life is eternal, full of knowledge and bliss. So, Krishna comes for all of us, but we have the choice, as the proper use of our free will, to surrender to him in loving gratitude for his purifying grace. Otherwise, we will have to face him as insurmountable burden of death, which brings everyone down to the same level. Better we assume that level voluntarily, that we are all das, das, amadas. So, we should approach Krishna with the desire that he will subdue our uncontrolled minds. And Srila Prabhupada said that actually devotees have mystic powers, but they don't know it because they don't want to know it, because those mystic powers tends to give rise to pride, and that is our greatest enemy. And the pastime of Ambarish Maharaj, which is so much cherished in the pages of Srimad Bhagavatam, that when cursed by that great mystic Durvasa Muni, who was offended, Durvasa Muni approached Ambarish Maharaj in Madhuva, in Vrindavan, after Ambarish Maharaj, for the welfare of his whole kingdom, had performed Ekadasi fast for one whole year. And just when it was time to break his fast, appears the great mystic, Durvasa Muni. And Ambarish Maharaj, although a great king, was so humble that he wanted to serve his host with love and kindness and offered to serve him prasadam when it was just time for the king to break his year-long fast. But Durvasa Muni said, first I will take my bath, and then I will accept your hospitality. And when he was bathing in the Jamuna, by this mystic potency, which has such effects that one can read the minds of others and understand what they're thinking, what they've done, what they're going to do. He has such mystic potencies, mystic abilities of mental aptitude. He understood that Ambarish Maharaj, seeing that the proper time to break the fast, which was necessary to honor, lest the fruits of that austerity be nullified, with some anxiety, he consulted the Brahmins and Vaishnavas, and they advised him, take one drop of charanamrita, which will break the fast, but won't offend a guest by actually taking your meal before him. But Durvasa Muni, because of his pride, he was offended. And he came back and he cursed Ambarish Maharaj, that you so much disrespected me that I will have to teach you a lesson. And then he created this huge fiery demon which just began incinerating everything like an inferno, and approached Ambarish Maharaj to incinerate him. And Ambarish Maharaj was not the least bit disturbed. He just offered his prayer to Krishna that if you like, you can have me burned to ashes. If you like, you can protect me. I'm your servant. I'm your property. Whatever you do, I surrender. And that humility in the heart of a devotee is the greatest mystic power, is the greatest force and ability in all creation, because it attracts Krishna. And because it attracted the loving protection of Krishna, the Sudarshan Chakra appeared on the scene and burned that fiery, infernal demon to nothingness. And then it turned to destroy Durvasa Muni. As a result of his own curse, could not affect Ambarish Maharaj. He was under the loving protection of the Lord, and it came back to himself. And he ran to every major demigod. First he went to the depths of the sea. The Sudarshan Chakra was burning his back, to the caves of the Himalayas, to Brahma Loka, Shiva Loka. By his mystic potency, he even pierced the coverings of the material creation, crossed the Brahma Jyoti, the Viraja, and approached the Lord of Vaikuntha for shelter. And the Lord of Vaikuntha, Sri Krishna, in his Vaikuntha form, told him, I cannot protect you. You're subjected to the reaction of your own curse, and your only redemption is in seeking the forgiveness of Ambarish Maharaj, whom you have offended. So then he went back after a whole year of fleeing from the burning of the Sudarshan Chakra at his back, and approached Ambarish Maharaj. He was still standing there with folded palms, praying to Krishna that he could properly serve his guest. And then when Durvasa Muni returned, Ambarish Maharaj, although the king of the planet, was so humble due to his surrendered will to the service of the Lord, he was so humble. He asked forgiveness from Durvasa Muni for the inconvenience, for the disturbance from the mental anguish, an ordeal of fleeing for a year from the Sudarshan Chakra, which was the whole time burning his back. Ambarish Maharaj begged forgiveness from Durvasa Muni. Such was the depth of his humility that it actually transformed the heart of Durvasa, which was so cruel and so hard-hearted because of his desires to exploit and control and the pride of his mystic potencies. His heart was melted by the superior power of the humility in the heart of Ambarish Maharaj, which attracted the loving kindness and protection of the Lord. And surrendering to Ambarish Maharaj, who fed him sumptuously with his own hands. Ambarish Maharaj fasted for 2 years, the duration of his vow, and while he was waiting for Durvasa Muni to come back from the Jamuna in the additional year, which he was fleeing throughout the universe right on up to Vaikuntha, Ambarish Maharaj fasted for 2 whole years, serving his host with such loving kindness, wanting to fulfill his every desire in personally serving him prasadam. And then only when his host was satisfied in every respect did Ambarish Maharaj take his own meal. And what was the result? Durvasa Muni left that place praising the exalted qualities, praising Ambarish Maharaj, glorifying Ambarish Maharaj. This time, traveling throughout the whole creation, glorifying the superior mystic potencies of Ambarish Maharaj, which Ambarish Maharaj did not even acknowledge in himself, because he was so afraid that this demon of pride and ego separate him from the loving protection and devotional service of the Lord. He did not know he even had such potency. He did not want to know, because that would simply impede his loving service to the Lord. And when one mystic yogi presented his potencies before Srila Prabhupada, and even Srila Prabhupada's disciples were quite amazed. Look at the potencies. And Srila Prabhupada responded, "Why don't you just give up all this nonsense and surrender to Krishna?" And he did. He became a life member. And he told the devotees that your Guru Maharaj is the best mystic because he understands these mystic abilities are simply nonsense. Simply some mundane show of desire to exploit and control and show and display one's own superiority over others. So he said that Srila Prabhupada is the greatest mystic. And Srila Prabhupada said, no. He just acknowledged that, you know, my mystic potency is that these devotees were addicted to all bad habits and bound in the cycle of their own karma, actions and reactions and samsara, had become Vaishnavas. But Srila Prabhupada did not accept the credit and glory for himself. He offered all glory to his own Guru Maharaj and the holy name of Krishna by whose mystic potencies. When that holy name enters the heart, the holy name, the glories of the Lord, how to keep Krishna always in the superior position, subduing our own whirling minds, Shimbata Swakita Krishna's Pumishavana Kirtana, Vedanta Stoha Vidrani Vidanoti Sudhisattva. By hearing the glories of Krishna, that when that transcendental vibration of Krishna's holy name and glories enters the heart, then Krishna himself within the heart begins cleansing all the egotistic desires to exploit and control. All the furies of anger and hatred are cleansed away by the Lord himself when we simply surrender to the process of hearing and chanting his holy names and glories, which must be accompanied by the expression of humility in serving others and desiring no respect or adoration. Offering all respects to others, Srinada Pisunichana, Torada Pisunichana, Amami Dhammami Kirtaneya Siddhaka. That this is the mood in which one should chant the holy name of the Lord. Humbler than a blade of grass, more taller than the tree, devoid of all sense of false prestige, and ready to offer all respects to others. Then, Krishna, who is very fond of stealing butter and yogurt, will steal away our own hearts from their pursuit of spiritual death and restore our consciousness to its proper place in the loving shelter of the most merciful Lord, Shri Krishna. Thank you very much. Are there any comments or questions? Humility means service attitude. When Arjuna wanted to go to the forest and become a mendicant, Krishna called him a fool because that was his pride. He was thinking that he knew better than Krishna how to deal with the upcoming conflict. That was his pride, wanting to follow the path of so-called non-violence and retreat to the forest. Humility means service attitude. It means surrender to Krishna's will, which is non-violence in the spiritual nature, and the spiritual level. Above the non-violence to the body is the compassion to the soul. Krishna was revealing. And Arjuna is wanting to be non-violent. It was a form of pride because he was thinking he knew better than Krishna. Krishna was asking him to fight. He thought it was inappropriate to wage war with his kinsmen. Krishna said, "You're a fool. Speaking, learning words, you're mourning for the body, which is not worthy of grief." So Arjuna's expression of humility was annihilating the core of his army as a fierce kshatriya. But it was in all humility, all surrender to the loving, compassionate will of him. So humility simply means service attitude, surrender to the will of the Lord and acting for the pleasure of the Lord, no matter what the activity may be. It is the consciousness of being an instrument in the all-loving, compassionate will of the Lord. That's what humility means. Service attitude. Surrender to the compassionate, loving will of the Lord. So Arjuna, when he rejected his only ambition to go to the forest and accepted Krishna's instructions to wage war, perfected his humility and showed us that there's false humility, which may mean some credit in this world, but it's just another form of aversion to Krishna. We may seek being praised as most humble. That's just false humility. Humility means surrender to the will of the Lord, as revealed through the guru of the Vaishnavas and sadhus. Whatever the activity may be, it's the internal motion of the heart to surrender all its words and deeds to fulfilling the desire of the Lord. Anything else? Thank you very much, all the rest of you.
should I get the pen? How many times do we make a question? Say 10:30. Maharaja, when you went to take a photograph at CBS, did you notice the open and Sunday? The open and Sunday? I have to.
I'm not sure about the photographs like that now. The drugstore's definitely.
Yeah, see, this is open photograph. I need to take some photographs for my King's Cup application. Maharaj, you know, I was thinking they want to make a service in the kitchen.
You look so right at home for a service.
Pardon?
You look so right at home for a service in the kitchen and service in the steering
mind. And I was thinking, I was doing the cooking, but my mind was somewhere else. It appeared that the spinal cord is doing some work and your head is going elsewhere. So is the mind in the brain?
Where's the mind? The brain is just your computer.
Okay.
The mind is something more than just really strong. You can go anywhere. I notice that your mind is not made.
And this thing then is that when we talk about heart, cognition, the heart,
so it's the soul. So it's the soul.
I didn't do that. Krishna Das did that.
Let me just serve it.